All right, hello everyone, and welcome to the Guiding Lights. And this is, of course, when I'm sharing what is the self. At least that's what I'm sharing. I'm really just sharing from Bernadette Roberts, and I could switch, you know, from one form to another, but I seem to be sticking with what is the self right now. So, hi Jay, hi Shana. again, I see two Jays. I wonder if one of the J's are Ron. Last time one of the J's was Ron, remember? So tonight I'm beginning on page 13 for those of you who like to try to read along. But again, I skip around a little bit. So that may be challenging. And I'm starting, there's a paragraph, the second paragraph on that page begins with Carl Jung suggested. And I'm actually starting near the bottom of that paragraph. Just read. So the center of consciousness is an energy. An energy unique consciousness alone. This energy is not responsible for sensory or vegetative life. Rather, it is solely responsible for conscious life. This energy is consciousness. It is the feeling self and the center of consciousness. And this morning when Jacqueline was teaching the weekly gathering, she spoke a little bit about emotions. And there were two different people who asked me, one public and one private, asked me what was the, you know, emotions about and the feeling self that Bernadette Roberts talks about. And when Bernadette Roberts is talking about the feeling self, she's talking about will. She's not talking about emotion, even though the word feeling is being used. She's talking about will. And she says that will, when it's an outward going will, right, it's either desire or avoidance. But when it's a still will, it's just that feeling of being or that feeling of existence. And she says that feeling of being or that feeling of existence is an energy. And if you guys have ever paid any attention when you're meditating and you're being still and you're focusing on life or the sense of existence, you notice that it's an energy. You can see that it's an energy. So she says, the center of consciousness is an energy unique to consciousness alone. Now she says, this energy is not responsible for sensory or vegetative life. And you may remember at the very beginning of our study, she talked about how animals have a purely sensory life. They don't have consciousness. And I think we've agreed that that may or may not be 100% true, that there may be some animals that have a purely sensory life, purely responding to what their senses show them. And there may be other animals that have this sense of consciousness, this sense that I exist, this self-awareness. But we don't know that for a fact. You know, we just can tell that different people disagree on the topic. You know, like I think I read one person during a weekly gathering. There were a couple of scientists that said that, for example, dogs have the same sense of consciousness that humans have. And many of us appear to experience that with our dogs. We can see what we think is a sense of consciousness. But I think it's important to realize that we don't know. But she's referring to the animals who have a purely sensory experience of life. And she's saying they do not have the same feeling self, the same energy, the same sense that I exist. This energy is not responsible for sensory or vegetative life. Rather, it is solely responsible for conscious life. This energy is consciousness. It is the feeling self and the center of consciousness. And what I'm doing now, I just wanted to read that, but now I'm skipping over to page 14. And there's a section here called Summary of the System of Consciousness, summary of everything that really we've been looking at so far since we've been studying Bernadette Roberts. And I'm starting with about the third sentence in. She says, the feeling, knowing self is not only the feeling and knowing of self, rather feeling and knowing is self. Self prior even to the feeling and knowing of self. This means that it makes no difference if, at this moment, we feel nothing and are not aware of ourselves, because self or consciousness is still present as the unconscious prior to any conscious awareness of a particular feeling. So, when I get very, very still, I am very aware of awareness, and I am very aware of this sense of existence. If I'm all caught up in the outer world, I am not aware of awareness, and I am not aware of the sense of existence, even though both are still present. And I think probably many of you know the same experience. So what she's saying is our sense of self is always present, even when we aren't consciously aware of awareness or consciously aware of the sense of existence. And that's because at an unconscious level, we are always aware of awareness and we are always aware of the sense of existence, right? And so it's because of this unconscious awareness that we always have a sense of self. And it's true, if I'm all caught up in the world, I have a sense of self. And in fact, that's when I might even become very, very selfish about my sense of self, right? And want things my way. And I couldn't become selfish about my sense of self and want things my way if the sense of self was not already there, right? So at an unconscious level, the sense of self is always there. So again, this means that it makes no difference if at this moment we feel nothing and are not aware of ourselves, because self or consciousness is still present as the unconscious prior to any conscious awareness or particular feeling. When, however, something rises to the conscious level, then we are aware of self. And it is this self we usually know, while the unconscious self we usually do not know. Everything we know and feel of self is, therefore, secondary to the unconscious act or function of the mind bending on itself, and secondary as well to the unconscious, largely taken for granted, experience of life and being. Now I'm skipping just a little bit to the middle of the next paragraph. If the mind could not see or know itself, there would be no experience and there would be no self to speak of, because the term could not have arisen. As things stand, however, this bending action creates the subject-object poles of consciousness. If it were not for self as object, there could be no knowledge of self as subject, no subject at all, in fact. So again, she's referring now back to the knowing self, which we talked about in the first several weeks, where the mind is bending on itself. And again, this is primarily unconscious in most humans. This awareness of self is unconscious in most humans. But if it wasn't there, she's saying, there couldn't be a sense of I as the subject. And I think the only thing that's important about this is I think that I know that I had this feeling for a long time, or this idea for a long time, and maybe some of you too, that awakening was seeing myself as the pure subject. And what she's saying is even the subject does not exist when you awaken to the absolute. And she'll talk a little bit more about how we can't imagine that, because all we've ever known is ourself as a subject aware of objects. So we can't imagine the awakening that goes beyond the I as the subject, right? But she's saying that once the mind is bending on itself and there's no self as object, there is also no self as subject. You know, you have to have an object in order to have a subject. And without that mind bending on itself, you have mirror, which is why she calls it no self. And moving on to the next page from the middle of the first paragraph. The point is that self cannot get rid of itself or cause its own cessation. Neither the reflexive mechanism, which is the knowing, nor the feeling center can ever bring about its own extinction. So this is something that we've heard before. And in fact, in A Course in Miracles, it refers to it as God takes the last step. But what she is saying, is there is nothing that we as a sense of self can consciously do to end the sense of self. She says, from birth, we have unconsciously taken the self experience for granted. Because of this, we cannot begin to imagine what it would be like to live without some form of self-awareness or sense of self. Indeed, the very idea might strike us as unthinkable, which it is. Even if we tried to catch self or self-awareness in the act, we could not do this because we are act. And in meditation, my ultimate experience at this time is the experience of being completely aware that I am aware of anything that I see. Even if I see observing occurring, I am aware of the observing. And so when you hear that, if you really listen to that, I am aware of the observing, you hear a subject and an object. And that's what she's saying. We can never catch the subject in that subject-object relationship that comes about through the bending of mind. You know, and there have been a number of times when I have been temporarily fooled into thinking I found the subject. And then I notice that can't be the subject because I see that, right? You can't catch the subject in the subject-object relationship. And that's what she's saying here. She says, even if we tried to catch self or self-awareness in the act, we could not do this because we are this act. And I think this is what makes awareness, watching awareness, so difficult for some people, is because they're still trying to find the self as an object. And you can't ever do that because whatever you find, you're always the one seeing it. Right? So you can't catch the subject, the self-awareness. You can't ever catch it. You can be aware of it, right? You're aware of the sense of being the subject, but you can't see or catch the sense of being the subject. She says, only when the reflexive mechanism ceases to function can it be known that all consciousness is reflexive and thus all consciousness is self-consciousness. Without the reflexive mechanism of the mind, there is no awareness of the self. because there is no self to be aware of and no self to be awareness. Now, again, I'd like to point back up here where she said, from birth, we have unconsciously taken the self experience for granted. And because of this, we cannot imagine what it would be like to live without some form of self-awareness or sense of self, right? But here what she is saying is when this reflexive mechanism ends, and she's going to talk a little bit about what leads to the ending of the reflexive mechanism. But she says when this reflexive mechanism ends, there is no self to be aware of. Even that subject disappears. And then again, it tells us not to try and imagine that because we can't. She says, what we usually find in our search for the true self is the profound feeling self, not the knowing self. This feeling self is not reflexive, and thus it is non-dual. So where the mind has the subject-object poles, right? There's the awareness that's aware of whatever it's aware of, the subject-object poles. The feeling self, the sense of I exist, the sense of I am, is non-dual. It's just, it just is what it is, this feeling of being. She says, the feeling self is not reflexive, and thus it is non-dual. As the singular feeling of life and being, the feeling self is incapable of the subject-object dichotomy, such as the knowing self. And the knowing self is capable of the subject-object dichotomy. She says, it is this feeling self we usually regard as the stable and true self. And again, Nisargadatta calls this the I am presence, right? And we consider that more stable, more at the foundation of what we are than anything else that we experience. When we start looking, you know, in the beginning we think we just are the body and the personality and the mind. But when we really start looking at, if you'll pardon the term, the different parts of me, the one that seems most stable, most genuine, most godlike is just the sense of existence or the sense of I am. And that's what she's referring to here. It is this feeling self we usually regard as the stable, true self. We might add that the surprise of the falling away of all self or consciousness is not the cessation of the reflexive mechanism. You know, even though we can't imagine, you know, this is, she's already told us, we can't imagine not being the subject, right? We can't imagine the reflexive, you know, when the reflexive mechanism is undone and there's no subject, no object. She says we can't imagine that. It's beyond us. But at the same time, she says that's not the biggest surprise when consciousness ends. We might add the surprise of the falling away of all self or consciousness is not the cessation of the reflexive mechanism. Rather, it is the falling away of the feeling self, or the falling away of the non-dual sense of existence. She calls that the surprise. That's what we didn't expect. Somehow we expected the singular, non-dual experience of life and being to be more eternal than the reflexive mechanism of the mind. But such is not the case. And you may remember last week she used the inverted triangle, where up here we had the subject-object poles. Let me move my camera a little bit. Up here we had the subject-object poles of the reflexive mechanism. That's the base of the triangle. And then it comes down to the feeling self, down to the feeling self, right? And that is the point of the triangle. And what she's saying is that when consciousness ends, the entire triangle disappears. And people don't expect that. They expect this part to disappear. But they don't expect this sense of life or sense of existence or sense of being to disappear. But again, I keep pointing back to Dr. David Hawkins and how when he walked through the final doorway, he looked and he said, "What's the only thing I haven't surrendered?" And he said, the only thing I haven't surrendered is this sense of life, right? And that was the final thing that he surrendered. We might add the surprise of the falling away of all self or consciousness is not the cessation of the reflexive mechanism. Rather, it is the falling away of the feeling self. Somehow we expected the singular non-dual experience of life and being to be more eternal than the reflexive mechanism of the mind, but such is not the case. But before we can discuss the true no-self event, we must first discuss a prior event, the falling away of the ego self and the transforming process this event initiates. It is only after this event, the falling away of the ego self, that we come upon the egoless condition, generally known as unitive or transcendental consciousness. So we're going to look just a tad bit at this falling away of the ego self today. But the very next section, which we'll work with next time, is called the ego. And that's where she's going to talk more about the falling away of the ego self. But of course, if you've been following Bernadette Roberts, you know she talks about two awakenings. The first awakening is the falling of the ego self. It's non-dual feeling self. Unitive self, and then the second awakening is the falling away of the non-dual unitive self, or the falling away of the complete triangle into the no-self experience. She says, while this egoless or unitive condition is the mature condition of man in this world, it is not his final condition or destiny. So awakening to the unitive state or awakening to consciousness is the most mature state that humans can reach. The second awakening is beyond human entirely. Right? Beyond human entirely. And again, even Dr. Jeffrey Martin told us this. He talked about how people who had awakened beyond a certain point were really no longer human. And she's saying the same thing. She says, we cannot come upon mature existence or right living until we first come to the egoless unitive condition. And one thing that really stands out to me in this sentence is the term right living. We cannot come upon mature existence or right living until we first come to the egoless unitive condition. So what this means is no matter how much of a, quote, good person we are, if the ego is still active in you, it is still conducting mischief. Right? I mean, you can't. She says you can't come to right living, which would be no longer conducting mischief, until the ego dies. I mean, think about that. So one of the things, of course, I just led the releasing the I am bad belief retreat. And one of the points that's made in that retreat is that things just happen. And in fact, Jacqueline this morning talked about how attack is not real because attack is love. Because we put out a call, you know, like we're constantly thinking about how unworthy we are, and therefore we put out an unconscious call that our brothers and sisters hear unconsciously that kind of say, prove to me how unworthy I am. And they, you know, unknowingly show up and do that. They might make a comment like, oh, you know, you look a little large in that, or or whatever they say, which proves our unconsciousness, proves our unworthiness. But what she is saying is that we are constantly going to be sending out these wrong signals, no matter how much we purify the mind. I mean, we may be sending out less volume of these wrong signals, but it's unfair of us to expect ourselves to send out no wrong signals and therefore receive no wrong-minded feedback as long as the ego is present. It's also unfair of us to expect to never give wrong-minded feedback, to never read in a wrong-minded way, as long as the ego is present. Now, obviously, by intense self of these wrong-minded signals, and we can react a lot less from the wrong mind. But to expect us to never act from the wrong mind as long as the ego is still present is an unrealistic expectation. I remember once Jacqueline and I had a conversation. I had got a little annoyed with Jacqueline. She and I had a conversation afterwards, and I said something like, "Don't expect me to be perfect," right? Well, see, that's what she's saying. We can't be. To have that expectation of ourself or others, as long as the ego is still present, is an unrealistic expectation. We cannot get to maturity or right living until the ego is completely gone. And that's something that's really important for us to hear, because then, hopefully, if we hear that clearly, we can see the ego in innocence.
Did you want to
keep speaking? Okay, am I back now?
Yeah, you got a minute left.
Okay, so what I was going to say, I think I might have forgotten what I was saying. I think what I was saying was that if we understand that right living cannot occur, you know, 100% right living cannot occur as long as the ego is still present, we can see the ego in ourselves and others in innocence. Right? Like, you know, of course, occasionally, you know, he or she is going to, you know, maybe act from ego regardless of how much attention they're giving to their self. The ego is still there. And so, of course, the ego is going to show up. But again, we don't want to use that as an excuse in ourselves, right? If we do act out from ego, as soon as we catch ourselves, we want to reel that back in and go back to our right intentions. Again, this sentence says, we cannot come upon mature existence or right living until we first come to the egoless unitive condition. Only the true unitive self is able to live fully and fearlessly in the world. It is only after the true self has been lived. Oh, I don't want to go to that sentence till next week, so that's another topic, so I'll stop there. So that's where I'll stop for today and releasing the mic. Sorry about my internet. We have been having trouble the last week and a half, and we have no idea why. You know, we called the internet people and they said there's no problem. So it is what it is. Bye.